Bodhi Raja Kumara Sutta. The Dialogue with Prince Bodhi. Translated by Rupert Gethin. This is what I have heard. Once the Blessed One was staying in the Bugger country at Sumsumragira, in the Basakal Grove in the animal park. At that time, Prince Bodhi had recently had built a building called Kokanada, but it had not yet been occupied by any ascetic or Brahmin or by any human being. Then Prince Bodhi spoke to the Brahmin student Sanjikarputta. "My good Sanjikarputta, go to the Blessed One, and having approached him, bow down at his feet with your head in my name, and ask if he is free of sickness and disease, if he is in good health and strong, if he lives at ease, saying, 'Sir, Prince Bodhi bows down at your feet with his head, and asks if you are free of sickness and disease, if you are in good health and strong, if you live at ease.' And then say, 'Sir, may the Blessed One along with the community of monks accept Prince Bodhi's invitation for tomorrow's meal.' 'Yes, sir,' replied the Brahmin student Sanjikarputta. Then he approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he saluted the Blessed One respectfully and exchanged pleasing and polite words with him before sitting down to one side. Once seated, he said to the Blessed One, 'Gotama, sir, Prince Bodhi bows down at Gotama's feet with his head and asks if you are free of sickness and disease, if you are in good health and strong, if you live at ease. He asks further whether Gotama, along with the community of monks, might accept Prince Bodhi's invitation for tomorrow's meal.' By his silence, the Blessed One accepted. Understanding that he had accepted the invitation, the Brahmin student Sanjikarputta got up from his seat and approached Prince Bodhi. Having approached, he said to him, 'I have conveyed your message to Gotama as you asked. The ascetic Gotama has accepted your invitation.' Then, when the night was over, Prince Bodhi had fine foods of different sorts prepared in his own home, and had the Kokanada building spread with white cloths down to the lowest step of the stairs. Then he said to the Brahmin student Sanjikarputta, 'My good Sanjikarputta, go to the Blessed One and inform him that it is time. The meal is ready.' 'Yes, sir,' replied the Brahmin student Sanjikarputta. Then he approached the Blessed One, and having approached, he informed him that it was time. The meal was ready. Then, early in the morning, the Blessed One put on his outer robes and, taking his bowl, went together with a community of monks to Prince Bodhi's home. At that time, the prince was standing in the outer porch waiting for the Blessed One. When he saw him, he went out to salute him respectfully, and then, letting the Blessed One walk ahead, he approached the Kokanada building. By the lowest step, the Blessed One stopped, and Prince Bodhi said to him, 'Sir, may the Blessed One step on the cloths, may the Happy One step on the cloths, in order that it will contribute to my long-lasting welfare and happiness.' At this, the Blessed One was silent. A second time, Prince Bodhi said to him, 'Sir, may the Blessed One step on the cloths.' A second time, the Blessed One was silent. A third time, Prince Bodhi said to him, 'Sir, may the Blessed One step on the cloths.' Then the Blessed One looked towards the Venerable Ananda. The Venerable Ananda said to the prince, "Gather up your cloths, prince. The Blessed One will not walk on strips of cloth. The Tathagata has regard for later generations." So Prince Bodhi had the cloths gathered up and had seats prepared on the upper floor of the Kokonada building. Then the Blessed One went up into the building with a company of monks, and they sat down on the appointed seats. And Prince Bodhi waited on the Blessed One and the community of monks, serving them with the fine foods with his own hands. And when the Blessed One had finished eating and washed his hands and bowl, Prince Bodhi brought a low seat and sat down to one side. Once seated, he said to the Blessed One, "Sir, my idea is this. Happiness cannot be reached through happiness. It can only be reached through pain. Prince, before my awakening, when I was not fully awakened but merely intent on awakening, I too had the idea that happiness could not be reached through happiness, but could only be reached through pain. So after some time, while still a young man with a head of black hair and the advantages of being in the first flush of youth, against the wishes of my mother and father, who wept, their faces covered with tears, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on ochre robes, and went forth from home into homelessness. Once I had gone forth like this in search of what is skilful, in quest of the ultimate state of sublime peace, I approached Alara Kalama. Having approached, I said to Alara, 'My friend Kalama, I wish to follow the spiritual life according to this teaching and discipline.' At this, Alara Kalama said to me, 'Let the Venerable Sir stay here. This teaching is one in which a clever person can quite soon come to live, experiencing and attaining for himself, through direct knowledge, what the teacher has understood.' So I quite soon, quite quickly, learnt his teaching. As far as mere mouthing of the words, mere repeating of what had been repeated to me, I declared my knowledge and assurance. I, like the others, claimed, 'I know, I see.' But then it occurred to me that Alara Kalama did not declare himself just by faith alone to live. Having experienced and attained this teaching for himself through direct knowledge, certainly he must live knowing and seeing this teaching. So I approached Alara Kalama, and having approached, I said to him, 'Friend Kalama, this teaching that you declare, how far have you experienced and attained it for yourself through direct knowledge?' In response, Alara Kalama declared the sphere of nothingness. Then it occurred to me, Alara Kalama is not the only one to have faith. I too have faith. He is not the only one to have energy. I too have energy. He is not the only one to have mindfulness. I too have mindfulness. He is not the only one to have concentration. I too have concentration. He is not the only one to have wisdom. I too have wisdom. Why shouldn't I apply myself to experiencing that same teaching which he declares that he lives, having experienced and attained for himself through direct knowledge? So I quite soon, quite quickly, came to live, experiencing and attaining that teaching for myself through direct knowledge. Then I approached Alara Kalama, and having approached, I asked him, 'Friend Kalama, this teaching that you declare, is it this far that you have experienced and attained it for yourself through direct knowledge?' 'It is this far.' 'Friend Kalama, this far I too live, experiencing and attaining this teaching for myself through direct knowledge.' This is a gain for us, friend, a fortunate gain for us, that we should live to see such a companion in the spiritual life. The teaching which I declare, having experienced and attained for myself through direct knowledge, is the one you live, having experienced and attained for yourself through direct knowledge. And the teaching which you live, having experienced and attained for yourself through direct knowledge, is the one I declare, having experienced and attained for myself through direct knowledge. The teaching I know is the one you know. The teaching you know is the one I know. You are as I am, and I am as you are. Come, friend, the two of us together should look after this community now. So Alara Kalama, who was my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on the exact same level as him, and showed me the highest respect. But it occurred to me that the teaching did not conduce to disenchantment, nor dispassion, nor cessation, nor peace, nor direct knowledge, nor awakening, nor nirvana, but only to rebirth in the sphere of nothingness. Finding no satisfaction in that teaching, I lost my enthusiasm for it and left. In search of what is skillful, in quest of the ultimate state of sublime peace, I approached Udaka Ramaputta. Having approached, I said to Udaka, "My friend, I wish to follow the spiritual life according to this teaching and discipline." At this, Udaka Ramaputta said to me, "Let the venerable sir stay here. This teaching is one in which a clever person can quite soon come to live, experiencing and attaining for himself through direct knowledge what the teacher has understood." So I quite soon, quite quickly, learnt his teaching. As far as mere mouthing of the words, mere repeating of what had been repeated to me, I declared my knowledge and assurance. I, like the others, claimed, "I know, I see." But then it occurred to me that Rama had not declared himself just by faith alone to live, having experienced and attained this teaching for himself through direct knowledge. Certainly he must have lived knowing and seeing this teaching. So I approached Udaka Ramaputta, and having approached, I said to him, "Friend, this teaching that he declared, how far did Rama experience and attain for himself through direct knowledge?" In response, Udaka Ramaputta declared the sphere of neither consciousness nor unconsciousness. Then it occurred to me, Rama was not the only one to have faith. I too have faith. He was not the only one to have energy. I too have energy. He was not the only one to have mindfulness. I too have mindfulness. He was not the only one to have concentration. I too have concentration. He was not the only one to have wisdom. I too have wisdom. Why shouldn't I apply myself to experiencing that same teaching which he declared that he lived, having experienced and attained for himself through direct knowledge? So I quite soon, quite quickly came to live, experiencing and attaining that teaching for myself through direct knowledge. Then I approached Udaka Ramaputta, and having approached, I asked him, "Friend, this teaching that he declared, is it this far that Rama experienced and attained for himself through direct knowledge?" "It is this far." "Friend, this far I too live, experiencing and attaining this teaching for myself through direct knowledge." "This is a gain for us, friend, a fortunate gain for us, that we should live to see such a companion in the spiritual life." The teaching which Rama declared, having experienced and attained for himself through direct knowledge, is the one you live, having experienced and attained for yourself through direct knowledge. And the teaching which you live, having experienced and attained for yourself through direct knowledge, is the one he declared, having experienced and attained for himself through direct knowledge. The teaching he knew is the one you know. The teaching you know is the one he knew. You are as he was, and he was as you are. Come, friend, you should look after this community now. So Uddaka Ramaputta, who was my companion in the spiritual life, placed me in the position of teacher and showed me the highest respect, but it occurred to me that the teaching did not conduce to disenchantment, nor dispassion, nor cessation, nor peace, nor direct knowledge, nor awakening, nor nirvana, but only to rebirth in the sphere of neither consciousness nor unconsciousness. Finding no satisfaction in that teaching, I lost my enthusiasm for it and left. In search of what is skillful, in quest of the ultimate state of sublime peace, I continued on my journey through Magadha until I came to the army township of Uruvela. There I saw a delightful place, a pleasing grove of trees, a river flowing with clear water, with easy access to its banks, and all around delightful villages for seeking alms. And it occurred to me that here was a delightful place. That was exactly what a son of family intent on striving needed for that striving. So I sat down right there with the idea that it was exactly the place for striving. Moreover, three similes, unheard of previously, spontaneously came to mind. Suppose there were a wet, uncured piece of wood that had been left in water, and someone should come along with a fire drill and get the idea that he would light a fire and produce heat. What do you think, Prince? Would he, taking his fire drill and turning it on that wet, uncured piece of wood that had been left in water, manage to light a fire and produce heat? Definitely not, sir. And why not? Clearly because the wood was wet and uncured, and moreover had been left in water, and that person's only reward would be weariness and frustration. In exactly the same way, Prince, there are some, whether ascetics or Brahmins, who live without having withdrawn themselves from sense pleasures, either physically or mentally. And their desire and fondness for, their infatuation with, their thirst and passion for sense pleasures, this is not properly relinquished, not properly stilled within. And if these ascetics and Brahmins experience feelings of sharp, violent, severe pain as a result of their practices, they are not ready for knowing and seeing, for the highest awakening. And if they don't experience feelings of sharp, violent, severe pain as a result of their practices, they are still not ready for knowing and seeing, for the highest awakening. Prince, this was the first simile, unheard of previously, that spontaneously came to mind. Furthermore, this second simile, unheard of previously, spontaneously came to mind. Suppose there were a wet, uncured piece of wood that had been left on dry ground far from the water, and someone should come along with a fire drill and get the idea that he would light a fire and produce heat. What do you think, Prince? Would he, taking his fire drill and turning it on that wet, uncured piece of wood that had been left on dry ground far from the water, manage to light a fire and produce heat? Definitely not, sir. And why not? Clearly because the wood was wet and uncured, even though it had been left on dry ground far from the water, and that person's only reward would be weariness and frustration. In exactly the same way, Prince, there are some, whether ascetics or Brahmins, who live, having withdrawn themselves from sense pleasures, either physically or mentally, yet their desire and fondness for, their infatuation with, their thirst and passion for sense pleasures, this is not properly relinquished, not properly stilled within. And if these ascetics and Brahmins experience feelings of sharp, violent, severe pain as a result of their practices, they are not ready for knowing and seeing, for the highest awakening. And if they don't experience feelings of sharp, violent, severe pain as a result of their practices, they are still not ready for knowing and seeing, for the highest awakening. Prince, this was the second simile, unheard of previously, that spontaneously came to mind. Furthermore, this third simile, unheard of previously, spontaneously came to mind. Suppose there were a dry, hollow piece of wood that had been left on dry ground far from the water, and someone should come along with a fire drill and get the idea that he would light a fire and produce heat. What do you think, Prince? Would he, taking his fire drill and turning it on that dry, hollow piece of wood that had been left on dry ground far from the water, manage to light a fire and produce heat? Definitely, sir. And why? Clearly because the wood was dry and hollow, and moreover had been left on dry ground far from the water. In exactly the same way, Prince, there are some, whether ascetics or Brahmins, who live having withdrawn themselves from sense pleasures either physically or mentally. Moreover, their desire and fondness for, their infatuation with, their thirst and passion for sense pleasures, this is properly relinquished, properly stilled within. And if these ascetics and Brahmins experience feelings of sharp, violent, severe pain as a result of their practices, they are ready for knowing and seeing, for the highest awakening. And if they don't experience feelings of sharp, violent, severe pain as a result of their practices, they are still ready for knowing and seeing, for the highest awakening. Prince, this was the third simile, unheard of previously, that spontaneously came to mind. So then it occurred to me that I might grit my teeth and, pressing my tongue against the roof of my mouth, I might mentally hold down my mind, crush it, and overwhelm it. So I mentally held down my mind, I crushed it and overwhelmed it, gritting my teeth and pressing my tongue against the roof of my mouth, with sweat pouring from my armpits. It was as if a strong man, grabbing a weaker man by the head or the shoulders, were to hold him down, crush him, and overwhelm him. Yet while the energy I put into this was unremitting, and the mindfulness I established was free of any confusion, I was overcome by the effort of this painful exertion, and ended up with a body that was without stillness. So then it occurred to me that I might practice only the absorption without breathing. So I stopped breathing in and out through my mouth and nose. Then, once I had stopped breathing through my mouth and nose, there was the terrible noise of winds coming out from my ears, like the terrible noise that comes from a smith's bellows being blown. Yet while the energy I put into this was unremitting, and the mindfulness I established was free of any confusion, I was overcome by the effort of this painful exertion, and ended up with a body that was without stillness. Still it occurred to me that I might practice only the absorption without breathing. So I stopped breathing in and out through my mouth, my nose, and my ears. Then, once I had stopped breathing through my mouth, nose, and ears, I had terrible winds pushing up in my head, as if a strong man were twisting a sharp knife in my head. Yet while the energy I put into this was unremitting, and the mindfulness I established was free of any confusion, I was overcome by the effort of this painful exertion, and ended up with a body that was without stillness. Still it occurred to me that I might practice only the absorption without breathing. So I stopped breathing in and out through my mouth, my nose, and my ears. Then, once I had stopped breathing through my mouth, nose, and ears, I had terrible sensations in my head, as if a strong man were fastening a turban round my head with a tough leather strap. Yet while the energy I put into this was unremitting, and the mindfulness I established was free of any confusion, I was overcome by the effort of this painful exertion, and ended up with a body that was without stillness. Still it occurred to me that I might practice only the absorption without breathing. So I stopped breathing in and out through my mouth, my nose, and my ears. Then, once I had stopped breathing through my mouth, nose, and ears, I had terrible winds cutting through my abdomen, as if a skilled butcher or his apprentice were cutting through the abdomen with a sharp butcher's knife. Yet while the energy I put into this was unremitting, and the mindfulness I established was free of any confusion, I was overcome by the effort of this painful exertion, and ended up with a body that was without stillness. Still it occurred to me that I might practice only the absorption without breathing. So I stopped breathing in and out through my mouth, my nose, and my ears. Then once I had stopped breathing through my mouth, nose, and ears, I had a terrible burning in my body, as if two strong men were to grab a weaker man by his two arms and roast him right through in a pit of hot coals. Yet while the energy I put into this was unremitting, and the mindfulness I established was free of any confusion, I was overcome by the effort of this painful exertion, and ended up with a body that was without stillness. Moreover, when gods saw me, they said, "The ascetic Gotama is dead." But some gods said, "The ascetic Gotama isn't dead, but he's dying." And some gods said, "The ascetic Gotama isn't dead, nor is he dying. He is an arahat. This is exactly the way arahats live." It occurred to me that I might take on the practice of cutting out food entirely. Then gods asked me not to take on the practice of cutting out food entirely. They told me that if I did, they would feed me through the pores with divine nourishment, and that I would be sustained by that. Then I thought that if I claimed to be keeping a strict fast, yet gods were feeding me through the pores with divine nourishment, and I was being sustained by that, then I would be lying. So I refused those gods and told them there was no need. So it occurred to me that I might take very little food, just a morsel at a time, whether of mung bean soup, lentil soup, chickpea soup, or pea soup. So I took very little food, just a morsel at a time of mung bean, lentil, chickpea, or pea soup. And when I did this, my body became extremely emaciated. My limbs became like the jointed stems of creepers or bamboo, because of eating so little. My backside became like a buffalo's hoof. My backbone, bent or straight, became like corded beads. My ribs jutted and stuck out like the jutting and broken rafters of an old house. The pupils of my eyes, when glimpsed, sunk deep in their sockets, were like the glint of water seen deep down at the bottom of a deep well. My scalp became withered and shriveled, like a fresh bitter gourd that has been withered and shriveled by the wind and sun. When I wanted to touch the skin of my belly, I felt my backbone. And when I wanted to touch my backbone, I felt the skin of my belly. In fact, The skin of my belly stuck to my backbone because of eating so little. When I wanted to urinate or defecate, I fell over right there on my face because of eating so little. I stroked my limbs with my hand in order to soothe my body, but because of eating so little, as I rubbed my limbs with my hand, the hairs, whose roots had grown rotten, dropped from my body. Moreover, when non-human beings saw me, they said, "The ascetic Gotama is black." But some non-human being said, "The ascetic Gotama isn't black, he's brown." And some non-human being said, "The ascetic Gotama isn't black, nor is he brown. His skin is sallow." So much had my skin lost its clear complexion because of eating so little. And it occurred to me that whoever in the past were ascetics or Brahmins who experienced feelings of sharp, violent, severe pain as a result of their practices, it was not beyond this extreme. Whoever in the future will be ascetics or Brahmins who will experience feelings of sharp, violent, severe pain as a result of their practices, it will not be beyond this extreme. Whoever in the present are ascetics or Brahmins who experience feelings of sharp, violent, severe pain as a result of their practices in the present, it is not beyond this extreme. And yet, by means of this severe, harsh practice, I had achieved no special knowledge and insight beyond the capacity of human beings and worthy of the noble ones. Might there in fact be another path to awakening? Then it occurred to me that I remembered that when I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree while my Sakyan father was engaged in work, I had spent time having attained the joy and happiness of the first absorption, which is accompanied by thinking and examining and is born of seclusion. Might this in fact be the path to awakening? Then immediately following that memory, I became aware that this was indeed the path to awakening. I asked myself why I feared this happiness, which was a happiness that had nothing to do with sense pleasures, nothing to do with unskillful qualities. Then I decided that I would not fear this happiness, which was a happiness that had nothing to do with sense pleasures, nothing to do with unskillful qualities. It occurred to me that it would not be easy to achieve this happiness with a body that had become so extremely emaciated. So I thought I should take some solid food, some rice gruel. Then I took solid food, some rice gruel. Now, at that time, there were 5 monks with me who thought, "The ascetic Gotama will inform us of any truth he achieves." But after I had taken some solid food, some rice gruel, those 5 monks lost their enthusiasm for me and left, thinking, "The ascetic Gotama is one for excess. He has given up the struggle and reverted to a life of excess." Once I had taken solid food and regained my strength, I lived completely secluded from sense desires and unskillful qualities of mind, having attained the joy and happiness of the first absorption, which is accompanied by thinking and examining, and born of seclusion. Then, by stilling thinking and examining, I lived having attained the joy and happiness of the second absorption, a state of inner clarity and mental unification, without thinking and examining, and born of concentration. By having no desire for joy, I lived equanimously, mindful, and fully aware. I experienced the bodily happiness of which the noble ones speak, saying, "Equanimous and mindful, one lives happily." And so I lived, having attained the third absorption. By letting go of happiness and unhappiness, as a result of the earlier disappearance of pleasure and pain, I lived, having attained the pure equanimity and mindfulness of the fourth absorption, which is free of happiness and unhappiness. Once my mind was concentrated in this way, once it was thoroughly purified and cleansed, stainless, without defilements, having become sensitive, workable, and steady, reaching a state that is unshakable, I applied and directed my mind towards the knowledge of recollection of previous lives. I remembered my numerous previous lives. One birth, two births, three, four, five births, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 births, 100, 1,000, 100,000 births, over many periods of expansion of the universe, over many periods of contraction, over many periods of expansion and contraction. I remembered, in that life I had that name, belonged to that family, that class, had that food, experienced that unhappiness, that happiness, and met my end in that way. When I died there, I was born in that place. There I had that name, belonged to that family, that class, had that food, experienced that unhappiness, that happiness, and met my end in that way. When I died there, I was born here. In this way, I remembered the various circumstances and details of my many previous lives. Prince, this was the first knowledge I achieved in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was dispelled. Knowledge arose. Darkness was dispelled. Light arose. As I lived attentive, determined, applying myself to this. Once my mind was concentrated in this way, once it was thoroughly purified and cleansed, stainless, without defilements, having become sensitive, workable and steady, reaching a state that is unshakable, I applied and directed my mind towards the knowledge of the death and birth of beings. With the godlike vision that is purified, surpassing that of men, I saw beings dying and being born. I understood how beings are inferior or superior, fair or ugly, fortunate or unfortunate, according to their actions. These beings behaved badly in body, badly in speech, badly in thought, disparaging the noble ones. They held wrong views and performed the sorts of action that follow from wrong view. At the breaking up of the body after death, they were born in hell, a realm of loss, misfortune, and torment. These beings, on the other hand, behaved well in body, well in speech, well in thought, not disparaging the noble ones. They held right views and performed the sorts of action that follow from right view. At the breaking up of the body after death, they were born in a happy heaven world. In this way, with the godlike vision that is purified, surpassing that of men, I saw beings dying and being born. I understood how beings are inferior or superior, fair or ugly, fortunate or unfortunate, according to their actions. Prince, this was the second knowledge I achieved in the second watch of the night. Ignorance was dispelled. Knowledge arose, darkness was dispelled, light arose as I lived attentive, determined, applying myself to this. Once my mind was concentrated in this way, once it was thoroughly purified and cleansed, stainless, without defilements, having become sensitive, workable and steady, reaching a state that is unshakable, I applied and directed my mind towards the knowledge of the destruction of taints. I truly knew what suffering is. I truly knew what the arising of suffering is. I truly knew what the cessation of suffering is. I truly knew what the practice leading to the cessation of suffering is. I truly knew what taints are. I truly knew what the arising of taints is. I truly knew what the cessation of taints is. I truly knew what the practice leading to the cessation of taints is. In the course of knowing this and seeing this, my mind was freed from the taint of sense desire. My mind was freed from the taint of being. My mind was freed from the taint of ignorance. And when it was freed, there was knowledge that it was freed. I understood, birth is destroyed. The spiritual life has been lived. Done is what should be done. There is nothing further required to this end. Prince, this was the third knowledge I achieved in the third watch of the night. Ignorance was dispelled. Knowledge arose. Darkness was dispelled. Light arose. As I lived, attentive, determined, applying myself to this. Then it occurred to me that the truth I had found was profound, hard to see, hard to understand. It was peaceful, sublime, beyond the sphere of mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation takes delight in belongings, is delighted by belongings, enjoys belongings. And because it takes delight in belongings, is delighted by belongings, enjoys belongings, it is hard for this generation to see the possibility of things having specific causes and arising in dependence on things. It is hard for this generation to see the possibility of stilling all volitional forces, of relinquishing all attachments, of destroying craving, of dispassion, cessation, nirvana. If I were to teach the truth, others would not understand me, and that would be distressing and hurtful for me. Moreover, these verses, unheard of previously, spontaneously came to mind. With difficulty I have made this discovery. There is no need now to explain it. Those overwhelmed by greed and hatred will not easily wake up to this truth. Going against the stream, subtle, profound, hard to see, fine, those impassioned by greed, enveloped in a thick darkness, will not see it. So, Prince, as I reflected in this way, my mind inclined to the least discomfort, not to teaching the truth. Then, Prince, when Brahma, Lord of the Earth, understood in his mind what I was thinking, he thought, "The world is lost. The world is finished. For here is the Tathagata, an Arahat, perfectly awakened, and his mind inclines to the least discomfort, not to teaching the truth." Then, just as a strong man might straighten his bent arm, or bend his straightened arm, Brahma, Lord of the Earth, disappeared from the world of Brahma and appeared in front of me. Having arranged his robe over one shoulder, he bowed to me with cupped hands and said, "Sir, let the Blessed One teach the truth. Let the Happy One teach the truth. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who will be lost if they do not hear the truth. They will understand the truth." This is what Brahma, Lord of the Earth, said. And then he spoke further. There appeared in Magadha previously a truth that was impure, conceived by those who are tarnished. Open the door to the deathless. Let them hear the truth that the one who is untarnished has awakened to. Like standing on a rock on a mountain peak and seeing the people all around, the palace made of truth is so. Wise One, ascend it, all-seeing one. People are immersed in grief. Let he who has left grief behind observe them, overcome by birth and death. Rise up, a hero, the victor in battle, leader of the caravan, owing nothing, wanderer in the world. Let the Blessed One teach the truth. There will be those who understand. Aware of Brahma's request, and out of compassion for beings, I surveyed the world with the vision of one awakened. As I surveyed the world, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes, and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, of good habits and of bad habits, easy to teach and difficult to teach. Some who lived seeing the danger in wrongdoing for the next world, some who lived without seeing the danger in wrongdoing for the next world. As where there is a clump of blue lotuses, red lotuses, or white lotuses, some of those blue, red, or white lotuses sprout in the water, grow in the water, and do not rise out of the water, but thrive while still immersed in it. Some of those blue, red, or white lotuses sprout in the water, grow in the water, and do not rise out of the water, but remain level with the surface of the water. Some of those blue, red, or white lotuses sprout in the water, grow in the water, and then rise out of the water and remain untouched by any water. In exactly the same way, when I surveyed the world, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes. Then I responded to Brahma, Lord of the Earth, with a verse. The doors to the deathless are open. Let those who will listen take heart. Brahma, thinking of the hurt, I did not utter the excellent and subtle truth among men. Then Brahma, Lord of the Earth, knowing that he had created the circumstances for the Blessed One to teach the truth, saluted me respectfully and, keeping me to his right, he disappeared right there. Then I considered to whom I should first teach the truth, who would quickly understand this truth. Then I thought of Alara, the Kalama. He was wise, clever, learned, someone who had long had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I were to teach him the truth first. He would quickly understand this truth. Then gods approached and told me that Alara the Kalama had died 7 days ago. And then the knowledge, the vision came to me. Alara the Kalama had died 7 days ago. I thought, great is Alara the Kalama's loss. If he had heard this truth, he would have quickly understood it. So again I considered to whom I should first teach the truth, who would quickly understand this truth. Then I thought of Udaka Ramaputta. He was wise, clever, learned, someone who had long had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I were to teach him the truth first. He would quickly understand this truth. Then gods approached and told me that Udaka Ramaputta had died the previous night. And then the knowledge, the vision, came to me. Udaka Ramaputta had died the previous night. I thought, great is Udaka Ramaputta's loss. If he had heard this truth, he would have quickly understood it. So again I considered to whom I should first teach the truth, who would quickly understand this truth. Then I thought of the group of 5 monks. They had been very helpful to me when they were with me, while I applied myself to the struggle. Suppose I were to teach the group of 5 monks the truth first. Then I considered where the group of 5 monks might now be living. With the godlike vision that is purified, surpassing that of men, I saw the group of 5 monks were now living in Benares, in the animal park at Isipatana. So having stayed at Uruvela as long as I wanted, I set out to walk to Benares. On the road between the place of awakening and Gaya, Upaka, an Arjavika, saw me. When he saw me, he said, "How serene your senses are, friend! How pure and clear the colour of your skin! Friend, under whom have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? Whose truth do you follow?" When he had said this, I responded with these verses. I have overcome all. I know all. Where there are all qualities, I am unmarked. Letting go of all, in the destruction of craving, I am freed. When I have direct knowledge by myself, to whom should I refer? I have no teacher, none like me is found. In the world with its gods, no person is my equal. I am the one who is worthy. I am the incomparable teacher in the world. I alone am perfectly awakened, cooled, satisfied. To turn the wheel of truth, I go to the city of Kazi. In this world that is blind, I will beat the drum for the deathless. According to your claim, friend, you must be the conqueror of the infinite. Like me indeed, the conquerors are those who have achieved the destruction of taints. I have conquered bad qualities. Therefore, Upaka, I am a conqueror. At this, Upaka, the Arjavika, said, Maybe, friend, maybe. Then, shaking his head, he left, taking some other path. Then I made my way in stages to the animal park at Isipatana, in Benares, where I approached the group of five monks. They saw me coming in the distance, and when they saw me they agreed with one another, Here is the ascetic Gotama coming. He is one for excess. He gave up the struggle and reverted to a life of excess. We will not salute him respectfully. We will not get up for him. We will not take his bowl and robe. But we will allow him a seat. If he wants to, he can sit down. Yet as I came nearer, that group of five monks was unable to stick to their agreement. Several came forward to meet me. Several showed me to a seat. Several set out water for my feet. However, they did address me by name and the title friend. At this I told the group of five monks, Monks, do not address one who is like this, Tathagata, by name and the title friend. The one who is like this is an arahat, perfectly awakened. Listen, the deathless is achieved. I will give instruction. I will teach the truth. If you practice as instructed, then soon you will come to live, having experienced and attained here and now for yourselves, through direct knowledge, the ultimate goal of the spiritual life, for the sake of which the sons of families quite rightly go forth from home into homelessness. At this the group of five monks replied, Friend Gotama, by means of your conduct, by means of your practice, by means of your severe, harsh practice, you achieved no special knowledge and insight beyond the capacity of human beings and worthy of the noble ones. And now you are one for excess, who has given up the struggle and reverted to a life of excess. So how will you achieve special knowledge and insight beyond the capacity of human beings and worthy of the noble ones? When they had said this, I said to that group of five monks, Monks, the Tathagata is not one for excess. He has not given up the struggle and reverted to a life of excess. The Tathagata is an arahat, perfectly awakened. Listen, the deathless is achieved. I will give instruction, I will teach the truth. If you practice as instructed, then soon you will come to live, having experienced and attained here and now for yourselves, through direct knowledge, the ultimate goal of the spiritual life, for the sake of which the sons of families quite rightly go forth from home into homelessness. Then for a second time the group of five monks replied, Friend Gotama, by means of your severe, harsh practice, you achieved no special knowledge and insight and now you are one for excess, who has given up the struggle and reverted to a life of excess. So how will you achieve special knowledge and insight beyond the capacity of human beings and worthy of the noble ones? Then, for a second time, I said to that group of five monks, Monks, the Tathagata is not one for excess. I will give instruction, I will teach the truth. If you practice as instructed, then soon you will come to live, having experienced and attained here and now for yourselves, through direct knowledge, the ultimate goal of the spiritual life for the sake of which the sons of families quite rightly go forth from home into homelessness. Then for a third time the group of five monks replied, Friend Gotama, by means of your severe, harsh practice, you achieved no special knowledge and insight. And now you are one for excess, who has given up the struggle and reverted to a life of excess. So how will you achieve special knowledge and insight beyond the capacity of human beings and worthy of the noble ones? At this I said to that group of five monks, Monks, do you recall my having announced something like this before now?
Indeed not, sir.
Monks, the Tathagata is not one for excess. I will give instruction, I will teach the truth. If you practice as instructed, then soon you will come to live, having experienced and attained for yourselves through direct knowledge the ultimate goal of the spiritual life for the sake of which the sons of families quite rightly go forth from home into homelessness. Prince, I was able to convince that group of five monks. I would advise two monks while the other three went to get arms, and the six of us managed on what the three brought back. I would advise three monks while the other two went to get arms, and the six of us managed on what the two brought back. In this way, that group of five monks was advised and instructed by me, and quite soon they lived, having experienced and attained here and now for themselves, through direct knowledge, the ultimate goal of the spiritual life, for the sake of which the sons of families quite rightly go forth from home into homelessness. At this, Prince Bodhi asked, Sir, when a monk has a Tathagata to direct him, how soon could he come to live, having experienced and attained here and now for himself, through direct knowledge, the ultimate goal of the spiritual life, for the sake of which the sons of families quite rightly go forth from home into homelessness? Then, Prince, I shall ask you a related question in return. You should answer it as seems appropriate to you. What do you think, Prince? Are you skilled in the art of handling a goad for elephant riding?
Certainly, sir. I am skilled in this art.
What do you think, Prince? A man might come along here with the idea that Prince Bodhi understands the art of handling a goad for elephant riding, and that he could learn this art from you? If he lacked faith, then he would not achieve as much as can be achieved by one who has faith. If he was often sick, then he would not achieve as much as can be achieved by one who is seldom sick. If he was dishonest and cunning, then he would not achieve as much as can be achieved by one who is honest and straight. If he was lazy, then he would not achieve as much as can be achieved by one who puts in effort. If he was dim-witted, then he would not achieve as much as can be achieved by one who is clever. What do you think, Prince? Could this man learn the art of handling a goad for elephant riding from you?
Sir, a man who had any one such quality could not learn the art of handling a goad for elephant riding from me. Never mind someone with all five.
What do you think, Prince?
A man might come along here with the idea that Prince Bodhi understands the art of handling a goad for elephant riding, and that he could learn this art from you? If he had faith, then he would achieve as much as can be achieved by one who has faith. If he was seldom sick, then he would achieve as much as can be achieved by one who is seldom sick. If he was honest and straight, then he would achieve as much as can be achieved by one who is honest and straight. If he put in effort, then he would achieve as much as can be achieved by one who puts in effort. If he was clever, then he would achieve as much as can be achieved by one who is clever. What do you think, Prince? Could this man learn the art of handling a goad for elephant riding from you?
Sir, a man who had any one such quality could learn the art of handling a goad for elephant riding from me, never mind someone with all five.
In exactly the same way, Prince, there are these five qualities associated with striving.
Which five? A monk has faith. He gains faith in the awakening of the Tathagata, that for the following reasons he is the Blessed One. He is an Arahat, a perfect Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, happy, one who understands the world, an unsurpassed charioteer of men to be tamed, teacher of gods and men, a blessed Buddha. He is seldom sick, seldom ill. He has stable digestion, neither too cold nor too hot, balanced and suited to striving. He is honest and straight. He is open about himself both with the teacher and with his experienced companions in the spiritual life. He lives putting in effort. He is firm, forceful in his endeavour to abandon unskillful qualities and arouse skillful qualities. He is not one to drop the task when it comes to skillful qualities. He has wisdom. He possesses the wisdom that understands the rise and fall of things, that is noble, penetrating, leads to the proper destruction of suffering.
Prince, a monk with these five qualities associated with striving, who had a Tathagata to direct him, could in 7 years come to live, having experienced and attained here and now for himself, through direct knowledge, the ultimate goal of the spiritual life, for the sake of which the sons of families quite rightly go forth from home into homelessness. Let alone 7 years, a monk with these five qualities could in 6 years come to live, having experienced and attained here and now for himself, through direct knowledge, the ultimate goal of the spiritual life. Let alone 6 years, a monk with these five qualities could in 5 years, in 4 years, in 3 years, in 2 years, in 1 year. Let alone 1 year, a monk with these five qualities could in 7 months come to live, having experienced and attained here and now for himself, through direct knowledge, the ultimate goal of the spiritual life. Let alone 7 months, a monk with these five qualities could in 6 months, in 5 months, in 4 months, in 3 months, in 2 months, in 1 month, in a fortnight, let alone a fortnight, a monk with these five qualities could in 7 days and nights come to live, having experienced and attained here and now for himself, through direct knowledge, the ultimate goal of the spiritual life. Let alone 7 days and nights, a monk with these five qualities could in 6 days and nights, in 5 days and nights, in 4 days and nights, in 3 days and nights, in 2 days and nights, in 1 day and night come to live, having experienced and attained here and now for himself through direct knowledge, the ultimate goal of the spiritual life, let alone one day and night. A monk with these five qualities, who had a Tathagata to direct him, will, when instructed in the evening, attain distinction in the morning, and when instructed in the morning, attain distinction in the evening. At this, Prince Bodhi said to the Blessed One, "The Buddha, the teaching, how the teaching has been well proclaimed when someone instructed in the evening will attain distinction in the morning, and when someone instructed in the morning will attain distinction in the evening." When he said this, the Brahmin student Sanjikarputta said to the Prince Bodhi, "The Honourable Bodhi announces the Buddha, the teaching, how the teaching has been well proclaimed," but not that he goes to the Honourable Gotama and to the community of monks for refuge. "Do not speak so, good Sanjikarputta. Do not speak so. I have heard this directly from my mother. I have learned this directly from her. Once the Blessed One was staying at the Gosita Park in Kosambi. Then my mother, who was pregnant, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, she saluted him respectfully and sat down to one side. Once seated, she said to the Blessed One, 'Sir, whether it is a prince or a princess in my womb, the child goes to the Blessed One for refuge, and to the teaching and the community of monks. Let the Blessed One accept the child as a lay follower who has taken refuge from this day for as long as it lives.' Once the Blessed One was staying right here in the Bagga country at Sumsumara Gira in the Besakala grove in the animal park. Then my nurse, who was carrying me on her hip, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, she saluted him respectfully and stood to one side. Standing there, she said to the Blessed One, 'Sir, the Prince Bodhi goes to the Blessed One for refuge and to the teaching and the community of monks. Let the Blessed One accept him as a lay follower who has taken refuge from this day for as long as he lives.' So, good Sanjikarputta, for a third time I go to the Blessed One for refuge and to the teaching and the community of monks. Let the Blessed One accept me as a lay follower who has taken refuge from this day for as long as I live."